Just Not Good Enough with Chaz House on FUBAR Radio.
Well, let's do an introduction first. So firstly, Nick Johnson, welcome to Just Not Good Enough. So what inspired you after your, obviously, career, your early stages of your career, which is more sort of commerce and business and managing people and leading teams, that you suddenly decided you're going to be a mental health advocate?
Yes, I could say that during my corporate career, you know, I realized that many times it was quite isolated. It was lonely, but I didn't talk to anybody about it. And that led me eventually to my rock bottom. And it's when I left the corporate world then about 10 years ago, and I realized that I was not the only one. As I started to interview and talk to senior executives, they also felt the feelings of isolation and loneliness. In fact, about 30% of them, at least here in Southeast Asia. And that's when I decided that I need to make an effort for this. And that, with that, I began to write my book, Executive Loneliness.
Because it's something that goes through your life in a way, is this executive loneliness. And I've got an experience of that as well, but I'm not sure that I was actually aware of it at the time. So at what point did this sort of kick in for you about loneliness?
Yeah, it was similar for me. I don't think I realized it at the time either, but being an expat then, working in Asia, you know, many times you don't understand the language, the culture and so on, and you tend to group up perhaps with other expats both in the office and then after office. And so perhaps there was a bit of a denial in there, and it is eventually afterwards when it really came clear to the degree that it really had an impact. Because while we're talking about mental health here, a big one is social health. We are social human beings, and if we are not getting the social connections, we are gonna suffer. And clearly I did suffer, and I got my social connection perhaps at the wrong places with the wrong people. So rather than building some real authentic tribes, which I built for myself now, many times it was easy just to go to the bar after work and drinking some beer. Those were perhaps people who were not my close friends, and they're not, for example, in my phone book these days. So I got it all wrong. And what I realized also is that many people who also didn't get it right.
Yeah. So what how did you realize, though, that it wasn't right for you? Because I've been an expat myself. I lived in Japan for 3.5 years, and I used to work in the alcohol industry. So I know exactly what that community is like. And it's very difficult to break out of it.
Yeah, and I had to fall quite deep in myself, in my journey. So I resigned from my job, but I didn't really know what I wanted. I was a bit lost, and panic set in, and I jumped from job to job and to pay, you know, the bills. And with that also, I became a bit delusional. I filed for divorce, and that left me even a lot more lonely. My ex-wife moved back to Sweden, and I was still in Asia, and she brought with us our son, who at the time was 5 years of age. And so I started to miss him as well, and trying to push on and, you know, trying to be a man and trying to find a new job. But instead of perhaps taking a step back and asking myself really what I wanted to do, I jumped into the wrong opportunities. And with that, I became even more isolated, and I fell into a deep depression. And to deal with that was to basically numb myself with alcohol. I started to drink too much at the time. Again, I was in denial about this, and it was only in 2018 when I really had enough of it. And I was basically sick and tired of being sick and tired, and I decided to own up to it. And I started to address everything from being heavily overweight to drinking too much, and just really, really sorting it out and working on myself.
How did it manifest itself, though? The point where you, I would say, cracked, let's say. You know, what was going through your mind? How did you feel? What emotions were you experiencing?
Yeah, so in 2018, I was quite lost. And I remember I relocated then from Vietnam to Singapore. And it was stressful then, start up a new country, new colleagues, new company and everything else. And at the same time, I was not really well myself. And at that time, I the biggest change was that it was so painful, basically, of keeping everything, you know, to myself, that eventually I exploded. And what happened then was that, you know, I spent so much effort to cover up for everything. I was acting to the world that I had it all together. I was acting like everything was fine. I didn't want anyone to know. But what really needed to happen was that I needed to share how I felt. And that was the change. The game changer was in April 2018 when I first decided to share with one person how I felt. And then that one person had joined me to a doctor when again I shared how I felt. Then we went together to a friend of ours who had gone through some similar challenges a few years ago. And again, I was open. I was vulnerable. I was honest, perhaps more honest than I ever been in my entire life. So within 24 hours, I've shared my story to three people. And that changed everything. It's like I had this V-shaped recovery. And they have this saying, a problem shared is a problem halved. So imagine if you're lying there and you're completely sick and you're halving your that issue three times in 24 hours. That's quite a big comeback.
I read somewhere that you even started, you know, not arranging your funeral, but planning it.
Yes, certainly. I couldn't figure my way out of it. And I wasn't suicidal because I was just basically in a gray zone. I was not motivated for anything. And I couldn't see myself how I would get out of it, how I would come out of this depression. I just had no idea. And therefore, those were the thoughts that came into my mind. And with planning for my funeral meant writing a testament, a will, arranging with life insurance, medical insurance, and sending all these documents to close relatives who, of course, started to wonder what's going on here.
And how did they intervene, did they?
Yeah, they asked me, but I was then, as long as I was in denial, I didn't share anything. But once I started to open up and shared it, then they, of course, understood what was going on, and they were offering and willing to support. Luckily, at that juncture also, I met a new woman who today is my wife, and she is like a guardian angel in the sense that she was by my side through this time, and I had someone I could share the challenges and what I was going through, and she was my accountability partner as well.
That must have been very fulfilling for you. But isn't it the issue here is getting over that hump, or getting out of the V, if you like, of actually talking about it and admitting your vulnerabilities and somehow getting over the stigma which still exists around it? And could you say that was the most important part for you, was just getting over that stigma?
Yes, absolutely. I had not until that moment had any sort of life coach or belonged to any confidential network where I have shared how I was feeling and how things were going. I just spent all my effort in covering it up and looking as good as I could on the outside. I didn't want anyone to find out what was really going on behind the scene. So that was the big game changer. And we are so scared perhaps of being exposed, but that's the best thing that ever happened for me, that I had to open up. And once I did that, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. And I call it like a journey of recovery. And it's almost like I lived two separate life. It's the before and after here.
Yeah, but isn't it a shame though that you have to sink that low before you can feel comfortable, if that's the right word, about exposing, you know, what you're thinking and what's going on. But, you know, and you've got to a point where you have a choice, don't you? Because you planned your funeral and you've done all of the right things there. And the alternative then is to, I'm either going to do something about this or I'm just going to take my own life.
Absolutely. And sadly, that's what happened to a friend of mine just a little bit later. When I was inside my recovery and things were going well for me, I then belonged to various support groups. I spoke to coaches, mentors. I'd be completely honest. And I had even been in the news and so on and shared some parts of my story. But once I lost my friend, that story changed. I decided to also be vulnerable openly, and which is why we are speaking today. And that was the beginning of my book, because I made a social media post on LinkedIn where I made a video about my support and then for the cause of a loss of my friend, where I want to raise awareness and funds for suicide prevention. And my post then on LinkedIn, and it's a bit over 5-6 years ago now, that one went viral. So many people were writing to me then and you know, giving support, saying that you know, not many people are comfortable talking about this. And I just replied, well, we need to be comfortable talking about the uncomfortable. And the more I did that, the more support I got, which again is why I decided to write the book and really to make an impact here and changing it. And these days I'm having these conversations with people and in different communities on a day-to-day basis.
Isn't there, you know, it's that transformational moment where you decide you are going to talk about it. But how do you get through to somebody who isn't prepared to do that just yet? They're not ready, or maybe they don't even realize what's going on, you know, but you can see the signs, can't you? Because I mean, I can see the signs now about people who, like in a bar, for example, behave as if they're the social god, you know, and the center of attention and all of that sort of stuff. But actually what these people are doing is they're acting, they're portraying a different character that probably isn't them. And when they go home, it's cost them a hell of a lot. And it actually just makes you go down even further. So how do you get through to somebody who's on that cusp, if you like, which is probably the most important point at which you should intervene?
Yeah, if we take one step further, then I believe, and this is what I'm doing in my work these days, we need to be very proactive to build up our safe spaces, and we shouldn't have to fall this low. We should already have coaches who we worked with on our life purpose and legacy in life. We should know what direction we want to go. We should then have these coaches as people we tell how we are feeling internally, and if there's something there, we ask for help. Therefore, we have therapists, perhaps psychologists, or other people around us who we also can speak to and ask for help. And I believe that for us men, for example, all need to belong to some men's group. In fact, my previous meeting today was one men's group that I'm sharing, where we're talking about various topics. The theme for today was masculinity and manhood. We spoke about that, and we're always sharing openly and honestly. So we're practicing what I talk about, the vulnerability muscle. And that's just like any muscle that we need to practice and grow. And if we are proactive about this and we have these safe spaces built up, we are surrounded like a squad around us of people, forums, and where we are honest and open about the challenges that we have in our life. Therefore, we will never reach the point that I did, where we're keeping it secret. It will be right there, exposed on a day-to-day basis. And that are the safe spaces that I'm passionate about building up today, both as a one-on-one coach where I'm working mainly with men, but also in this men's group and so on.
Yeah, on that men's group, I mean, this is going to sound awful, but, you know, in today's modern age, having a man's group, could that be seen as exclusive to a particular group of people and not inclusive enough to obviously the female side of the population?
I believe that women do this much better than men, and there was this woman leadership groups and much longer before us men, so we are quite late in this, and I certainly believe these groups are very much needed and in fact life-saving as well. So I don't think we have to be shy about having these groups, and I'm sure there'll be other combination of these groups as well. But as long as we have our own tribe, and you know, we live in a society where people might not have time for it. I have the luxury now to spend time quite a lot in Phuket, where I do triathlon, so swimming, cycling and running. I belong to a triathlon group, and we meet up every day for trainings together. So I have the social support there. We are quite open and honest with each other together there. But many people these days are busy running their life, looking after the family, working, and don't have those social networks. So therefore, something like a men's group is utterly important. And the one I facilitated just before here today is a weekly one that I run, and it's online for 1 hour, and it's on Zoom. There's other networks, and I also belong to multiple groups where we meet in person, and I find that in-person connection is important as well.
Yeah, I guess it's just you said earlier about the fact that women are much better at opening up and talking about these things. Would the introduction of some female company into your man's group, yeah, actually help, or do you think that would make people feel that they can't expose their vulnerabilities?
I think it has a time and place for that. And also, I'm a guest speaker quite frequently in women's groups, when they want to hear from a man's perspective and so on. I'm presenting in one in just 2 weeks from now. So I think that's definitely good to have that influence from time to time, and we can learn a lot from each other. And also, I think linked back to this is the research I did around my book shown that women typically had a few close friends who they were vulnerable with, a few who they were more open with than us men. And that was also the case for me, actually. I had close friends, good friends, I thought, but we played golf together, we went to the bar and had a drink and had a good time together, but I didn't share the issues that was going on in my work life with them. I saw them to have a good time, to forget about the challenges in the office that I might have had. Of course, the next morning when I came back to the office with a hangover, the problem was still there. I hadn't had the opportunity to build up authentic, deep, vulnerable relationships with my male friends. And these days I know better. I try to do this also on a one-on-one level with my male friends.
Yeah, I mean, alcohol is something obviously we'll talk about. Let's talk about it now. But it's actually is worse, isn't it? I mean, alcohol, when you start drinking, is an escape. You know, it means that when you're in a bar situation, not only do you not open up, but there's an element of not actually having the language to be able to do that, particularly for men, obviously. But then the alcohol takes its toll, and in the mornings when you wake up, you actually feel worse. Then you might have had a good time and a good laugh, but actually you feel worse. And I don't know about you, but I'm not sober like you are, and we're going to come on to talking about the Sober Club as well. But I'm coming to the conclusion now that I wouldn't say I drink too much, but it has an effect on how I interact with other people. I mean, did you find that as well?
Yeah, I only knew basically to socialize with people at some time in the bar after work. I had a window of an hour or two on the way home from work, and it was the bar. I became a regular, saw the same friends and had a couple of drinks and so on. And yes, it affected me negatively because I still also liked to run and so on. But many times, perhaps if you stayed for one more drink, that meant that maybe I canceled the run before the next day, or I felt a bit awkward. And yeah, it took a toll on me. And I'm glad that I managed to break this pattern and have not had a drink since 2018 now. That's still always work and maintenance in progress. I mean, we live in a society where alcohol is so socially acceptable, and it's everywhere, and it's seen as something that is part of just normal society and not really considered and thought of as a drug with a negative negative effect it actually has on us. So that is something that I'm passionate about, because I realized that it was making a lot of damages. And I'm an introvert, but it made me an extrovert hanging out in the bar and having a lot of loose talks. I really much more enjoy to meet in smaller functions with people and having deeper conversations like we are having today.
Yeah, there's a word that comes out in a lot of what I've read about you is about authentic relationships. And you could argue, couldn't you, that the people in bars, that's not an authentic relationship because you're pretending to be someone else. And I suppose they could be as well, actually, for that matter.
Yes, it goes from both sides there. And I think also when you've had a few drinks, you're changing the basically the intelligence and the conversations. We all know that. Yes. If we are sober in the bar after an hour, it's quite painful, isn't it?
Yeah. So you gave up drinking in 2018 and haven't had a drink since. How did you manage that? How did you actually achieve that? Because that's the hardest thing, isn't it? The temptation is always there. You know, you can't go anywhere where you go around for dinner with somebody and before you know it, they've got the wine out, and, you know, you might have a gin and tonic to start with and so on. And then all of a sudden you can tend to lose the conversation with the people that you're with because they go off into that area that, you know, people who drink go to. And as a sober person, you find it really difficult to relate to that. So how did they manage that?
Yeah, so I think once I sobered up, I was still maintaining some of my friends from my drinking life, but I was, you know, eventually taking some stand and I didn't stay out for too long and so on. But what I did, I was really building up new networks, new friends through clubs and associations and so on, with hobbies I had, some hobbies that I didn't fully explore before, including then picking up triathlon, which meant that I joined swimming clubs, swim academies, I joined cycling clubs, I joined running clubs and then triathlon clubs. I also then picked up my speaking career. I was already a speaker, but I wanted to step up the game. I joined a professional speaking association, which was a lot of networking. And also I doubled down on my coaching, joining cohorts, keep studying new different formats of coaching in different directions and so on. And therefore I picked up all these cohorts, all these social friends, and there was no room perhaps for the loose conversations and just going to the bar to have a conversation. So therefore I very rarely meet someone at the bar now. In fact, most of the time I meet someone for coffee or breakfast. And tomorrow morning I'm going out for an ocean swim here at 7:30 a.m. in the morning with a group of people, and we go for breakfast after. So I just changed my social life, and it's much more meaningful.
Yeah, that's
there's no argumentation.
Yeah, no, actually, that's interesting. I mean, the idea of going for an early morning swim and having a breakfast rather than working your nuts off and going for a beer after work and eating some junk food, perhaps, you know, is transformational, isn't it, to the way that people live their lives and how they feel and how they interact and just generally your well-being.
Yes, absolutely. It makes a huge impact. And also the kind of food that I was consuming when I was drinking, it was pizza, fast food, cheese platter, yeah, and sausages and so on. And that's not the kind of food that you want to have for a breakfast when you've been out for an ocean swim. You want to have perhaps a coffee, a fresh juice, and some healthy breakfast.
Yeah.
And what a different start to the day rather than a hangover to come
from
an ocean swim and breakfast.
I'm still at the stage, I guess, where I find it difficult not to have a drink when I go out in the evening. I'm getting better at not drinking at home, which is a start. But yeah, you eat shit when you're, when you've had a few beers and so on. And I now have a really healthy breakfast with, you know, natural cereals, fruit, bananas, all those sorts of things. And it's amazing how, one, my skin tone and condition has improved, but also I actually feel so much lighter in terms of the responsibilities that I have to bear. And it's extraordinary how all of that works, you know, and your body functions start to improve and all of that sort of stuff. And it does make me wonder why lots of people just don't do it anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of health benefits by avoiding alcohol, at least if you drink it in the quantities that I was doing at the end. I mean, I'm not going to comment at all about social drinking because that was not something that I necessarily enjoyed either. I can remember going for a party on a Saturday afternoon and just having two beers. I thought that was quite boring, so I might as well just skip it. I wanted to have more. I wanted the effect if I was drinking, because I had a lot of issues in my life I hadn't dealt with. And it was only when I really had sobered up and took ownership for everything and started to sort it out, then I realized I don't need alcohol. I don't actually have the craving for it anymore, because I dealt with issues that was there.
Yeah, do you think, I mean, it takes a lot of strength to do that, doesn't it? You know, and do you think that the revitalized habits, if you like, that you put into your life, or you brought into your life, was actually giving you the strength to be able to make you get better? So you end up in this spiral upwards that, you know, you start at the bottom and bit by bit by bit, the spiral takes you higher and it becomes a natural part of your life.
Yeah, absolutely. It's about owning up to your own mistakes and your own issues and attack basically your character defects and really work on them, and do that in a one-on-one setting with coaches, mentors, and also in group settings, in group therapy, group coaching, and in men's group like we discussed, or women's group or whatever there is. There's so much support out there. There's so much books, materials, and ways we can work on ourselves these days that we shouldn't have to hide. We shouldn't have to hide behind a drug. And now we just touched on alcohol, but there's also recovery programs out there for everything from gambling, sex, food addiction,
drugs.
And for drugs, for everything else, right? And it's just the same thing. It doesn't matter what drug of choice there is. We are running away from something. And for the young generation, it's social media that is perhaps the biggest addiction.
Yeah, that's a massive worry for me. I mean, I've got two youngish sons, they're sort of late 20s, early 30s, but their social media, particularly the younger one, it frightens me to death, actually, because the time spent and the inability to lift your head up and just see the stuff that's going on around you, and building, like you said earlier, we are social beings. You know, we need to interact with other people. There is an element, though, my son would say, is that actually on social media, the interaction with other people is on social media. That's my network. That's my village, if you like. But you never get to see these people. Well, if you do, it's fleeting. And how many times you go into a pub these days and see people on their phones? You know, when they're with a couple and they're both on their phones, I'm thinking, for Christ's sake, talk to each other, you know. So I mean, does that worry you as well?
Yes, it does. And in fact, I'm giving a TEDx talk in Indonesia here in September on a related topic, because they called me up from TEDx and said, we have a major issue with sleep among the young generation in Indonesia now, because they're up on the mobile phones. And so my TEDx, which I'm crafting now, is really about some healthy habits around that. We need to be quite disciplined and schedule and put the rules on ourselves. I mean, as we are young, we have parents to do that. But once we become teenager, we need to be quite strong and disciplined ourselves and put rules. It's just like we need to have rules and discipline ourselves so we don't consume too much alcohol, which I did.
Yeah.
But others perhaps are struggling to have that self-discipline on themselves with social media and put boundaries.
Yeah. I mean, you said earlier, I think, that you were overweight as well, which obviously your exercise has helped and your change in your diet has helped. But do you think, because this was certainly me when I was young, I comfort ate because it just made me feel better. And as a consequence, I was overweight, borderline fat, and I got bullied as a result of it. So, you know, I've actually self-imposed the comfort eating, not realizing what was going on, and setting myself up to be bullied at the same time.
Yeah, and certainly that's an issue. And I think for many these days, it's also the stigma in even discussing these conversations, right? And also, how do you approach someone who is overweight? We have to be careful in how we open this conversation. So it goes back to the whole thing here, that we need to have these safe spaces and forums where people themselves recognize the issues they have, and they raise these issues and they own up to them and are willing themselves to work on it. Because even if a parent is pointing to a child that they have an issue with social media, it's just going to start perhaps a conflict or an argument between the father and the child, for example.
And then they get rebellious.
We need to find another way.
Yeah. So how where are you on things like these self-help books and lists of things that people can do?
I'm more into community and connection. I'm more into meeting in person is the best, but online and being in forums, talking, so knowledge sharing and discussing, I believe, is the better. And having different themes and covering, like tonight, as I said, we discussed in the men's group masculinity. Another time it would be sleep. Another time nutrition. Another time it will be how to make amends for relationships where perhaps you have hurt someone. So I believe more in that kind of style of, should I say, education. Of course, reading books and so on the theme is there, but it's better to do it together and learn and with coaches and mentors and groups.
Yeah, it's because it's not a magic bullet, is it? You know, because I have read some of these things, and it didn't happen to me, fortunately, but I hear that people do read these things and they think, right, that's the answer. I need to do that and I'll be fine. But of course, it doesn't work like that. You know, it's like a New Year's resolution, which I think on average lasts about 17 or 18 days. You know, you think, right, if I do this, this and this, and then, you know, your will goes, your strength and resolve goes, the discipline goes, you suddenly find there isn't an instant result, and you actually get worse, possibly, because you've tried these things and they don't work. But so I think you're absolutely right. I think it's about interacting with other people. But there again, I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with Michael Mosley, Dr. Michael Mosley, who is, he died sadly just fairly recently. He has this thing called Just One Thing on the BBC, and there's about 40 different things that you can do every day. And the key to it is not to try and do them all, but pick the ones that you can just be part of your life, you know, and they're really, really easy. So, you know, things like have a cup of coffee, eat an apple, You know, breathe through your nose, stand on one leg, stand up. You know, so simple that you can just merge them into your everyday life. And the benefits overall, like I was saying about the way that I'm eating differently now, that along with what Michael Mosley has recommended has helped me immensely.
Yeah, and that is habits, right? Implementing these small little habits in our lives. Then, and we're talking about atomic habits and so on. Those books, they are referring to a 1% change, and it's a when you make multiple changes, small changes, they accumulate. And that's perhaps, you know, how I became an Ironman triathlete. And I just pick up the habits, and I ask the other athletes, I learn, I read, I listen, I see them, and I just keep doing it. And the issue I would say is that most of the time people expect quick results.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as quick results. Whatever you do it a little bit, but you do it every day consistently. Eventually you're going to become that kind of expert or really good in anything.
Yeah, but I think for you though, and I guess for a lot of people who do this, giving up alcohol is an all or nothing, isn't it?
There is no such thing as trying to, you know, reduce or cut or go halfway. But at least if you have some issues with it, if you have perhaps people are talking about an addictive personality. So, and I certainly have one for good and bad. So I just have to manage it and make it a good one and make, for example, a healthy diet, exercise and community. And discipline and exercise being the good ones I'm addicted to instead.
Yeah, well, credits you for all of that. I think that's excellent. Can we move on to business? Because, you know, all of this stuff is, I cannot believe, and I'll pick the FTSE 100 here. There are, you know, 1,200 directors, let's say. I cannot believe that none of them have vulnerabilities and mental health issues, but very few have actually admitted to it. So in your coaching, have you come across these very senior people who are actually prepared to admit their vulnerabilities, not just to you, but to the companies that they work for or work with?
Yeah, so on a one-on-one level with me as a coach, I find men and women, for that matter, also opening up to me. But normally only if they've had some issue. Perhaps it's been a loss of a job or a divorce or an accident, or maybe they got diabetes because they've been eating poorly or something. There's got to be some pain point there normally for people to really be ready to open up. And then it's on a one-on-one level. And to do this in a group setting, and this is what I do with my workshops. I travel around all around the world and do workshops with teams where typically I come in for half a day and I share my story and my rock bottom and what happened there. I also share other stories about other leaders who also had issues and then what happened to them, and then they can see the paths. And then in the workshops, they got to start talking to each other and sharing some issues. They have to share the most difficult time in their life and what happened. So they get to know each other on a vulnerable level where they are really open and authentic, because often in the workplaces we never had these conversations. So it's about actually we need to come in and facilitate this to happen in that kind of environment, and step by step opening it up and again getting them to practice that vulnerability muscle, then it can happen. And what I do then is I typically prepare the leadership team, at least the GM or the person in charge of this, before in a couple of one-on-one session, and they have to admit something. They have to stand in front of the group and be vulnerable first. And this is a bit prepared so that the rest of the team should feel safe, that this is now a safe space. And my boss just shared that he actually went through something very difficult during the pandemic, where perhaps he fainted because he was so stressed or whatever happened. It's just that he's sharing something openly. And I would like to also hear what you have to say about this, but I have much more on this topic because this is what I do day in and day out.
I know, and I'm glad we've got onto it. But yeah, for me, right, because I mean, I was a finance director of a PLC here in the UK. And up until the point where we listed, it was great, right? Because it was a sort of family business. It wasn't quite, because it was probably a bit too big. But then when we listed, we ended up with two of the original executive team on the board with about 6, 7, 8 non-exec directors. And the mood changed completely. And we've suddenly found that we've got white, grey, old, middle class people on the board who behave in a certain way. And the reason they behave in a certain way is because that's what made them successful in the past, because the people that they were working for behaved in that certain way. And I'm really interested in how we break that behavior, because what, as you know, and I think you've written about it many times, is whatever the board are doing, whatever the behavior that they're expressing, that filters down the organization. And you get the exact opposite of what you've just said about getting the leadership team to open up, because they don't, because it's seen as to be weakness. It puts a threat on their career, you know. And unfortunately then, because I got bullied in the boardroom, you know, I ended up feeling just not good enough, which is why we're here. Yeah. And I tried really, really hard not to do that down to my team. But what that then does is puts extra pressure on me and responsibility on me, because I'm just absorbing all of this bad behavior and trying not to replicate it in the team. You know, was I successful or not? I don't know. I'd like to think I was, and perhaps you should ask the team. But I just think there's this board level behavior and attitude and, well, let's call it bullying. It is absolutely bullying that somehow we've got to try and stop. And I don't know how to do it. And I keep asking people, and it's really difficult. It's really difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why we need to be proactive about this. We need to actually, again, I come back to these safe spaces. We need to have coaches, mentors, as senior leaders by ourselves, and work on everything here and practices in a safe space where we can feel that, you know, we are not exposed. And then doing it in a team setting. And I can share one example, because when I interviewed executives for my book, then around 2019, 2020, we were coming into the pandemic. And of course, there was lockdowns and people were isolated.
Yeah. That's an added complication, isn't it? Yeah,
it was. And I remember I interviewed a woman for the book, and she was at the time a managing director for one of the big international banks. So a powerful woman in a man's world, basically, at least in Asia. And she didn't give up much to me in the first interview. And I realized, well, this is not going to make it to the book. But then the day after, she sent me an SMS and asking if we could meet again. And I went to see her. As soon as we sat down for a coffee, she started to cry. And I gave her time and space. And eventually she said, Nick, I want you to know that I rehearsed my own suicide twice.
Wow.
So that's one
planning it, but two rehearsing it. That's very close, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And then with my permission, we called a therapist who came and helped out here. And he, with her permission, called a husband who also joined the conversation. And it was brought to air. And similar, like in my case, when I was exposed, I stopped the alcohol addiction the day after. I have not had a drink since after I was exposed, and everything else come together. She had a similar experience. And what we did then, I asked her for permission to include her story in my book, and it's there inside the book. And then when it was printed, she had not yet told her staff that this episode have happened. She got a copy of my book to all her leadership team and management team, and she asked them to read it. And then in an all hands meeting, she stood up and said, by the way, that woman working in a bank is me. And everyone was completely shocked. They had no idea that this same senior executive, this boss who they looked up to, could have gone through anything like this.
And
they were all
hiding it.
And surprised.
Yeah, just that. And yeah, she's hiding it.
Yeah, exactly. She managed to hide it so well that they had no idea. But what happened then was that the culture changed like that overnight.
Yeah.
Immediately everyone started talking about their issues. Oh yeah, I also had this issue. Even her senior board members started to open up. And since then they had a wonderful culture. So that's all it takes.
Yeah, it does. I know. I quite often ask people what their plastic bag moment is. And in the UK, the government introduced a 10p tax, if you like, on plastic bags that you get in Tesco's and the supermarkets and so on, and they disappeared overnight. And it was one small intervention that changed the way we view plastic bags. And it's exactly the same in the sense that this person, this chief executive or whatever she was, decides to talk about it. The culture changes overnight, and actually it's okay, isn't it? So how do we get it's one thing that worries me, and particularly as I have two young sons who are at the early stages of their career, and I suspect they've both got mental health issues as well, actually, but that's probably because of me. How do we create the right environment for them where there is still this bullying culture at the top to be able to feel that they can say things without compromising their career, without being sidelined? And I think the statistics are, you know, frightening in that 70% or something of people who admit that they've got a mental health issue either get fired or get pushed sideways. So, you know, they've got financial worries, they've got career worries, they've got family worries, and then they lose their job. You know, so you've got this contradiction, if you like, between what you want the culture to be and what it actually is. And how do you get over that?
Yeah, so it's very important for all of us then to have these safe spaces where we can talk about the issues, the challenges that we are facing. And yeah, coaches and mentors are good. I remember in my career, though, I was often given a mentor, which was someone who was more senior in my same organization. No. Of course, I wouldn't be open and vulnerable with this person. No. It's the wrong person.
Yeah,
it's the wrong thing. It needs to be someone outside the organization, someone where there's trust. And we have to, as individuals, be quite proactive and find these people if you don't have a company where they are supporting and providing this. We just have to speak up. We have to be open and honest when there's challenges we are facing. And I can just link this back to my family. So my son is 15 years of age now, a teenager. And when he had some issues at his school about a year and a half ago, I spoke to him about it openly, what was going through. And I asked him if he would like to have an independent coach, someone who could speak to him, someone who specialized in teenagers, to talk through him with these challenges. And he agreed, and he had a couple of sessions with this coach. And it led to the most remarkable outcomes. He shared much more with her that we knew as parents, and with his permission, she shared it with us. And in the end, actually, he changed city and school because of what was going on at school. And we might never have uncovered this unless we found this neutral and safe person for him, because a teenager is not going to suggest and go out and find this by himself.
No.
have the responsibility as parents and as leaders as businesses to provide this.
But I think that's quite a mature attitude from your son. Is it your son?
Yes.
Yeah, your son at that age, at 15, to say, yeah, okay, I'm going to have a coach. Because I can't think of any others. You know, they're more interested in, you know, being top of the league or top of the gang or in the right group of people and so on, you know, and mental health is, you know, and the fear of missing out and all of those sorts of things. And then the social media thing and the Instagram thing. But the thought of actually going to get some help externally is pretty good.
Yeah, and we didn't say that it's a coach as such, but he had some issues at school. This had been, you know, shoplifting. There's been some kids bringing in drugs to school, and it was someone who had a knife to school. And he was concerned about it. And I just asked how he could help and so on. And would he talk to someone and talk through it? And that's what he did. And he started to build some trust with this person and shared more and more. And of course, in a coaching environment, we never judged him. We never blamed him for anything. The coach then only asked, you know, what can we do about it? What would you like to do it? What solutions do you see to this problem? And he would lay out the different solutions he saw. And one of the solutions that he suggested was to change school. And that was eventually what he did. And it has had a positive outcome. So at least he was responsible for his own decision.
Yeah, that's really important, isn't it? You have to be responsible for your own decisions. You know, people can put you in front of stuff and in front of people to talk about it, but actually, ultimately, it's got to come from inside you, and you've got to want to do it. You've got to have the passion to be able to do it, and you also have to be very courageous, I think, by going down that path, because you could easily get bullied as a result of it.
That's why it's exactly his dilemma. So I remember at the time he said, I have this issue, Dad, if we go into a shop and other kids are stealing something, then if I steal, then the police might catch me. If I don't steal, I will be bullied or beaten. That was the kind of dilemmas that was going on. That was actually what was happening. And that is very difficult. And what do you answer as a parent to that?
Well, I mean, Christ, I don't know. But, I'm struggling to find an answer, and here I am, you know, slightly older and more experienced than you, certainly your son, and possibly even yourself, although your experience is fantastic. So do you ever come across business leaders at the very top who just patently refuse to acknowledge that they've got a vulnerability, or don't understand that mental health and well-being of their staff is an important issue and becoming more so? And if you do, and I'm sure you have at some point, how do you deal with them? I mean, how do you try and persuade them to say, look, hold on, guys, this is a major issue, and it's you that's causing the problem? Perhaps not putting it quite like that.
No, I think they just fall off the radar. They get an invite to an event. They are the ones who, even as a senior leader, they will not have a coach. They will not join seminars, workshops. They will just focus on driving the results. They be the powerful leader who just delegate relentlessly and probably have the results, but it comes at the cost perhaps of their own mental health and also the team. So if someone is working in an environment like that, then if you cannot reach them, then just try to change to another environment. Fortunately, what I see in the young leaders and the young generation is that they are not like that. I think we are a dying breed of dinosaurs, and I'm hoping for a more positive future here. That's at least what I see.
Now, I think you're right, but it takes a generation or two, doesn't it, for it to filter through the system. And it's the people coming up now who, and you probably sensed this, that they actually choose the company they want to work for, not just because they're successful or they're profitable or they pay the most, but actually because it's a good place to work, and they actually look after you, and the work-life balance is right, and you know, you're not given too much responsibility too early, and they train and develop you, you know, and I just think what a fantastic potential that shows for future generations.
Yeah, absolutely. It's about having this not the old style delegation culture, but more a coaching culture. That makes all the difference when we're inviting the team for them to have their own opinions, their own suggestions, and work with that rather than just throwing everything or pushing it downward, and which is sort of how I started at least my career. My bosses were very, very clear structure, sort of military style, and what you needed to do.
It doesn't work, does it? It just does not work, you know. And I think the cleverer people get, if that's the right way of saying it, the more that they think this is not for me, and they end up looking for something else. You said you change your environment, and you always have that choice, but that introduces an element of risk, of course. But you do have a choice to say, I've had enough of this, and then you look at it from the business's point of view, you know. And I think you've spoken about it in the things that you've written, is about you end up with people leaving, it costs you more to recruit, it costs you more to develop people, you get absenteeism, you get presenteeism, you know, you get sickness and illness, leave and so on. And the business case for that, even if the bloke himself, the CEO himself, says, I haven't got any mental health issues and I'm not interested, the business case, the commercial case is compelling, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the return on this, and I've been studying this as I obviously do a lot of talks on this, and if you have a leader who has a coaching mindset and really are inviting, of course, the team to share their views and so on, the team engagement, of course, goes up. The number of sick days goes down, and the staff turnover goes down. And ultimately, you know, your profitability of your company will increase. I mean, this is not rocket science.
No.
We spoke about before, if you just change some habits, 1 or 2%, we're not talking 1 or 2% here. We're talking 5, 10, 15, 20% increase in productivity. What is that going to do to the company?
Yeah, but why don't people do that? Why don't the people see this? Is that because, as you said earlier, they're dinosaurs?
I think it is, again, the fear of being, you know, in the spotlight, and just like how I was hanging on to myself, how I was scared to open about my issues or challenges. I mean, alcohol was one of them, but other issues that I needed to own up to was also making amends and setting things right in my life. Both institutions, I had overdue credit card bills, I was behind on some student loans at the time. There was other things I needed to clear up, and I was running away from these issues instead of dealing with them. And I did that by, you know, working myself too much and drinking alcohol and other things. But once I owned up to everything and dealt with everything, set things right and made amends, and broken relationships were repaired, then there was no reason for me to drink anymore. And that's where everyone needs to go, I believe, as a leader. There will be maybe a broken relationship with a parent, and that could affect everything. We need to repair those broken relationships so that we can be a good human being for ourselves and those around us.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that you talk about is how people go through that process, if you like. And the first thing, I think, was surrender. Yeah, and I mean, that people think surrender is an interesting word because it sort of implies giving up, but actually it doesn't. It's the complete opposite, isn't it? It's saying, oh, I surrender to this, right, I'm going to do something about it. And it's actually a sign of strength, not a sign of giving up.
Absolutely. With surrender starts everything, you know. Once you do that, it's just to admit to yourself that the way that you've been living, or perhaps a habit that you have protected so much, is no longer serving you. So it's about to surrender to that and really look from an empty page and find a new path. And it's just so refreshing. It's like you get a second chance in life.
Yeah, that is so powerful, but it's quite hard to persuade people to do that, isn't it? I mean, in my experience, you know, I've come across a lot of people whose leadership styles are appalling, and I've often wondered, is that because they have a mental health issue, or because the other way round, if you like, their leadership style is causing a mental health issue? And I, you know, I don't know how you break that cycle. I think it's really difficult. But through coaching, I guess you can start to get to, provided it's anonymous, if that's the right word, or confidential at least, you can start to get to somebody and just make them think in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's formats for this in everything, and I can refer back again to the recovery programs. And I mean, we all have heard about the 12 steps, and there's 12 steps for every addiction or issue that is out there. There's even the anonymous debt collectors, the anonymous business debt collectors. There's something for every issue any human being will have. And the thing is then that we are not the first one who's going through this. We're not going to be the first one ever in the universe who had an alcohol problem, a social media addiction, drug problem, or have ended up with the bad financials. There would be people who've done it before, and those people are there to help and give back. So for everyone who's listening, I would just encourage you to take a look at yourself, an honest look at yourself. And if there is any issue there, then it's about owning up to this and, yeah, going into one of those meetings, and they are complimentary, or it's a dollar or two as a donation maximum. And there are people who've gone through it and who can help anyone. So that is a good starting place for anyone if there's something they need to work on. But if a senior executive is too shy to go to one of those meetings, yeah, then there's coaches there, of course, that you can hire and work on the one-on-one level.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's great advice. So what's next for you then, Nick? Where you're continuing, I guess, with all your coaching and your triathleting and all of that. Do you do that around the world, by the way?
Yes, I was in Europe last week. Yeah, I actually competed back in my home country in Ironman Sweden there. So I go around the world, and I'm going to New Zealand in December for the half Ironman distance, the World Championship. I qualified in my age group, so I'm participating there in the World Championship. And
wow!
And yeah, I
representing
all around the world.
Representing Sweden.
Yes.
Oh, good for you! Wow! I met a guy who won in triathletes. I think won an Olympic bronze medal for Britain. And I mean, honestly, I was just in awe of it. You know, you don't often see these people because they are, you know, very, very few and far between. But I just thought, bloody hell, you know, I wish I had that talent and commitment. So good to you. Excellent stuff. So any future projects on the go at all that you might want to share or just think about?
Yeah, so I'm also writing my second book now. Wow. So while my first book was sort of to identify the issue around executive loneliness and highlight how big stigma it is around discussing it, and my purpose was to normalize this conversation, which is now work I've done for 4 or 5 years here. And the second book is really to take it to the next level. And it's about really identifying your life purpose. And I'm reflecting a lot on my life, that the big decisions in my life, for example, the profession I chose from the beginning was perhaps based on my dad. The wife
That's
I chose
very common.
Was based on my mom and dad to please them and what I thought was right. Then the subjects I decided to choose at university was influenced again by other people. And I've now basically taken a step back and re-looked at all those major decisions, and I'm changing the decisions now. To give you an example, 20 years ago, 22 years ago at university, I wanted to study psychology, but I was the one who was too scared. I was full of fear. I thought it's too difficult, so I didn't do it. But I identify that now in my work, and I'm going back actually in October now to start studies towards
Excellent.
A Master of Psychology.
Excellent. well done you. That is just absolutely fantastic. And you, expat for life, do you reckon? Although I suppose you're not really an expat now, are you?
Well, I'm a global citizen, actually. I mean, I was born in Sweden, educated in Australia, and 20 years in Asia now. But I have a small apartment in Sweden. I spend summers in Europe, typically, and then the rest... based in Asia, but traveling quite frequently around the world, speak at conferences and so on.
Excellent. Well, look, I mean, we're going to have to wrap up now because we've run out of time, which is amazing. It's been very quick. So all I can say is congratulations, Nick, to what you've achieved in your home life and your personal life and indeed professionally and all the work that you now do. So really, really well done. And thanks ever so much for coming on Just Not Good Enough. You know, I hope, well, I'm certain that this will have helped an awful lot of people, you know, over the course of them listening to this, and might actually change a few people's lives, which would be great.
Fantastic, Charles, and thank you so much to all the listeners as well.
Yeah, all right. Thanks a lot. Cheers. Thank you for tuning in to Just Not Good Enough with me, Chaz Howes, a radio show all about mental health. As a reminder, you can catch up with all recent shows on fubarradio.com.